Well, hey, Titus, why don't you help me out here? Got two sheets to pass out this time.
No, I got you ice and I got you water.
So. Oh, I know.
Two sheets I can
do. Okay, yeah. The second one is maps. Well, actually, give me one of each. They're not great maps. They didn't print out all that well, but
excuse me now. So, maps are hard.
We are talking about the barbarian period, the rise of the barbarian nations in Europe, between about the period, the period we're looking at over the next couple of weeks is especially the period about 500 AD to about 1000 AD. We're going to be moving. If there was ever a time that could accurately be called the Dark Ages, this would probably be it. It was a very difficult time for the church. The church lost a great deal of ground during this period. Due actually not to the barbarians, but due to the Muslims. So we'll look at Muslims later, but due to the Muslims especially, the church lost about half of its territory, including all of its original territory, which was quite a blow for the church to recover from. We'll look at the major effect that the Muslim challenge held for the church and the reason why that was especially difficult. But today we're looking at the barbarian nations. If you look at, on this map, the black and white map that's on one side there, let's look at that a little bit. So looking at the period. Actually, if we back up a little bit, we talk a little bit about the barbarian invasions that led to the fall of Rome or the Western Roman Empire. But you can see there the Huns, the Vandals, the Franks, and the Visigoths especially. The Vandals, the Franks, the Visigoths, the Lombards, the Alemanni, and many others were, all Germanic tribes or Teutonic. These were people that lived around, especially around the Black Sea and Caspian Sea area. What drove these migrations, and these were migrations. These incursions of barbarians were not just armies. They were whole peoples. Like literally an entire tribe would pack up and move. Men, women, children, everybody. Why did they do that? Well, the main reason, if you look at that map on the black and white, you see that name right over all the way on the upper right hand side. Who sees that name there? Who is it? It's the Huns. Most of them were running away from the Huns. Attila the Hun and his empire was conquering that whole area, and the movement of the Vandals and Franks and Visigoths in a lot of ways was them getting pushed out of Central Europe by the Huns. And so there were two things that were happening through the third and then into the fourth century. On the one hand, and stop me if any of this sounds familiar, but Rome was entering a period of great decadence, and one of the most practical outcomes of that was that people stopped having babies. The birth rates fell dramatically throughout the Roman Empire, the native population, in the third and into the fourth century. And the result of that was a couple of things. A whole lot of unfarmed land, a whole lot of good land in Europe that just wasn't being worked because there just weren't people there to do it. And a great difficulty in filling the ranks of the army sufficiently to guard the borders. So the very first, you see over there next to the Black Sea, you see where the Visigoths came in. The Visigoths crossing the Danube was a big, big deal. Because again, what happened was the Visigoths and the king of the Visigoths was a man named Alaric. This would have been early in the 4th century. He's got the Huns behind him, and the Roman Empire, they don't want to let them come into the Roman Empire. The Danube River was the border of the Roman Empire in that area. But they made a deal, and the deal was that the Visigoths could cross in, they would let them come in, they would let them occupy that space, and then they could farm the land, they could pay taxes to Rome, and they could defend that border from the Huns. That was kind of so they let them have this land, and because again, there wasn't really anybody there, and so they said, better to let them fight the Huns, and have the land, and we get some tax revenue out of it. Well, pretty quick, the Visigoths weren't happy with the deal anymore. They became less than content being second-class citizens, and that's kind of what led to the problems. So the Goths and the Vandals were the... Now, you might have... Yeah, I've used the term Visigoth a few times. There were two main branches of the Gothic tribes. They were the Goths, generally, but there were the Ostrogoths and the Visigoths. That just means Western Goths and Eastern Goths. It all had to do with where they ended up settling. The Visigoths ended up settling in the west of the empire in Spain, and the Ostrogoths stayed in the Germany area, but then ended up kind of getting absorbed by the Franks later on. All these tribes, besides being church history, is also very much the history of Europe. Our modern European nations all arise out of these tribes, out of these movements. France, Germany, Denmark, the Netherlands, Spain, all of those nations arose originally from these tribes. So there were the Goths, the first ones we talked about. The Goths ended up in if you see the movements so the Visigoths started, you see they started over there in the east by the Black Sea. They came down, they went down through Greece, they sacked Rome. They ended up landing in the Iberian Peninsula, what is now Spain. To understand now a couple of important features about these tribes, especially the Goths and the Vandals, they became Christian pretty quickly after they came into the empire, but they converted as Arians. You remember, Arians were the ones that did not believe that they didn't believe in the Trinity. They didn't believe that Jesus was God. That's relevant for a couple of different reasons. Probably the reason they did that is because in their mind, I think there are a couple of reasons. One of them is that Arianism in a lot of ways was just always closer to a pagan view of the gods and God, in that there's this kind of hierarchy of the gods and there's a hierarchy of worship. Also the early Christian Roman emperors, the first there was Constantine, but then the next several after Constantine until you get to Julian were all Arians. And so the barbarian tribes may have thought of Arian Christianity as kind of the older, more prestigious, associated with Rome's more golden era. And thus adopt the Goths and the Vandals both adopted Arian Christianity. And that takes us to the second important thing to know about these tribes. These tribes did not want to destroy Rome. And they didn't destroy Rome. They wanted to be Rome. They adopted Roman names. They adopted Roman language. They adopted the Roman law code. They became so indistinguishable from Romans that, like in Iberia, even though a minority of the tribes that came in were the Visigoths, pretty quickly you can't tell the difference anymore. You couldn't have reliably identified which people were Romans and which people were Visigothic. They interbred. They just wanted their piece of the pie. Basically, so for most people in most of Europe, when these tribes came in and took over, most of the time it did not lead to any kind of radical change in anything. Things, they had different rulers, But things pretty much stayed as they were. Actually, in a lot of cases, things actually got better for a lot of the people of Europe after the Germanic tribes took over, because for one thing, their tax burdens weren't nearly as high. So the Goths came through, as you can see there. The Goths, they kind of, and again, remember, this is whole tribal groups, you know, tens of thousands of people. The army, of course, but then also the women and children and their animals and everything, just kind of tramping across Europe. And they all landed in Spain. The Vandals that had come ahead of the Goths, they traveled through. They came down to Spain, but you see there, they actually crossed across the Straits of Gibraltar and came down into North Africa and ended up settling in North Africa. What's now Tunisia, Algeria, Morocco. And again, they were Arians. That area was, at the time, a stronghold of Orthodox Christianity. You remember we talked about Augustine a few years ago. Augustine was from this area. Augustine of Hippo actually died in Hippo, Hippo Regia, at the age of 75 in the middle of a Vandal siege. The Vandals had Hippo under siege. And Augustine was part of that siege, and they think it may have been concern for what was going to happen when Hippo lost the battle, which they almost certainly were going to, because they were Arians again, and Augustine knew. Remember, nobody thought anything about freedom of religion back then, and Augustine knew full well that it was going to mean the death or the conversion of most everyone in the town. And these were his, he was the Bishop of Hippo. These were his people. These were his congregation. The Vandals, you could just kind of tell by the name, right? We get the word vandalism from the historic behavior of the Vandals as they traipsed through Europe and then North Africa. After they were in North Africa, you see, then they came up to, they sailed across the Mediterranean and sacked Rome in 455 AD. Historians believe that of all of the Germanic tribes, probably the one the most responsible for the fall of the Western Roman Empire was the Vandals. Just because of the tremendous amount of damage they did as they, just the things that the amount of loot that they took and destruction that they engaged in all the way across Europe. So the Visigoths ended up in Spain and southern France. The Vandals ended up there were a lot of other tribes, that we haven't really mentioned a great deal. There's the Alemanni and the Lombards, and we'll get to the Saxons and the Angles and the Jutes here in a little bit. So what happened to the Goths in Spain? The Muslims took over Spain in the early 700s, and then the surviving Christian kingdoms in Spain were limited to the north and started fighting back against the Muslims, and it took them about 700 years, but eventually they pushed the Muslims back out of Spain. And by that time, this is why when we think of Spanish people today, we think of them as a little bit darker skinned, you know, a little bit more tan. They were originally a Germanic people, just like the French or the Germans or anything. They were the Goths. But then the Muslims took over, and that process of first the Muslims conquering it and then being gradually pushed out led to so much interbreeding between the Goths and the Moors, who had taken over, first as their conquerors and then being conquered, that had altered the bloodline forever, so that the modern Spanish are a different, very, very much a different bloodline now than the Northern Europeans. It's also, by the way, the exact same reason why Italians tend to be darker. And that's not even universally true of Italians, just as it's not universally true of Spanish. Northern Italians look very much like Northern Europeans. They're pale skinned, light skinned and fair. And Southern Italians are darker skinned, darker hair. And that's because of centuries of Muslim conquest. So. The Franks. Now the Franks were not one distinct tribe, the way that the Goths and the Vandals were. They were a coalition of tribes. They were a number of tribes who had allied together. And there's always debate about exactly where the name Franks come from. There's two major candidates for where the name comes from. One of it is it refers to a Frank being a statement of exemption from taxes. Because it was a similar situation as the Vandals. The Franks, as they started to push into, across the Rhine River into what is now France, the Romans there gave them the right to settle along the western bank there and farm the land and to protect it from other barbarians. They would guard the frontier in exchange for having the land. And so they had this exemption, and that exemption was called a Frank, and they think that might have been where the name came from. The other possibility is that it comes from their distinctive axes and the distinctive way they used the axe. There was an axe called a Francisca. And it was a throwing axe. And this was something pretty unique that the Frankish tribes did. They would all have a pair of throwing axes besides their main. They would have their shields out. And so when you'd line up in your shield wall, and normally then the two sides would line up in their shield wall, sort of like the offensive and defensive line in a game of football. Battles of this time looked almost nothing like the way you see it in Hollywood. In Hollywood, it's much more exciting for lots of people to be running around in chaos and heroes swinging. And actually, ancient warfare looked a lot more like a football game than it did like anything you'd see in Hollywood. You'd get your two shield walls, you'd slam your two shield walls together, they'd push back and forth like that, and somebody'd get a break in the line, and then they'd pour through, and they'd get you from behind, and they'd blitz the quarterback, and down they'd go. It actually looked, I mean, the game of football was modeled after medieval warfare. That's why it looks so much like it. But the Franks, when they lined up, as they were charging their shield walls in, the first thing they would do is they would all throw their axes all in a like that. And it was to people that were not used to fighting the Franks, it was really, really dramatic. You'd be lining up like this and you'd be starting to go, and all of a sudden there's this whole all these axes flying at you. And it would even if you had your shield up, the force was enough often to break the shield, often to break the arm that was holding the shield, or to embed itself in the shield, which then made the shield kind of useless because it had this big heavy thing hanging off of it. So they'd have two axes, they'd throw their axe, they'd throw the other one as they charge, and then generally the other line would break, and then they'd run and they'd pick up their axes while they were charging in and throw them again. So the Franks were, it was called a Francisca, and the Frankish tribes, the name of the coalition may have developed from the name of that particular axe and that particular tactics. That's not unusual. The Saxons are named after their weapon as well, the sax, which is a short sword, a particular kind of curved short sword that they used. S-E-A-X, a sax. So the Franks came. The Franks really became instrumental in the course of European history. They came in as the empire is collapsing. The Franks more and more came to dominate the area that's now known as France. France gets its name from the Franks. As they weakened, they kind of settled throughout various areas of Gaul. They adopted Christianity, but crucially, Clovis, the first king of the Frankish kingdom, adopted Catholic Christianity, meaning Trinitarian Christianity. He was not an Arian, and that was huge because The Franks came to dominate Europe for a lot of years, and the fact that they were Trinitarian instead of Arian was tremendously important, especially the Arian kingdoms. You remember who were the big Arian kingdoms? They were the Vandals and they were the Goths. Those got overrun by the Muslims. But the Franks stopped them. The became Christianity, but again, this was a whole lot more about aping the ways of glorious Rome than it was, and actually the Franks in France tended to pick up a lot more of the immorality and decadence of Rome than they did the Christians, although the church did the best they could. To this day, the French people have never been all that religious and have been far more concerned with strong government. But nonetheless, after the fall of the Western Roman Empire in 476, and remember, 476 is kind of an arbitrary date. That was when Odoacer, he was a general in the Roman army of a group of auxiliary, they were barbarian tribes, just came down and deposed the king and declared the Kingdom of Italy. But after that, so the Franks united into what was called the Merovingian Kingdom. Merovingian Kingdom, this was occupying the territory that is now France. Clovis was a strong leader, but after that it devolved into infighting. The Merovingians had a practice of the kings would always divide their kingdom between all their sons. So if you had four sons, then you divide the kingdom into fourths, and each son would get one fourth. Well, what was the inevitable result of that? Civil war every time the king died. That's what always happened, and it's greatly weakened the Merovingian Empire over the time. And so in 732, so the Merovingian kingdom, as I said, was plagued with division and infighting. Their kings became greatly weakened by the 8th century. By the 8th century, by the early 700s, the de facto ruler of the Merovingian Empire was the mayor of the city of Paris. The mayor of the city of Paris ended up, as often happens in kingdoms and empires, the actual emperor or the actual king just becomes a figurehead. The Queen of England hasn't had absolute power in England or the king now. It's not a queen anymore. It's hard to get used to that. for hundreds of years, you know, the king hasn't had a lot of power in England. So they were these mayors of Paris. They were administrative officials that de facto held all the power. In 732, a Muslim army from Spain, remember, Spain had been conquered by the Muslims by now, a Muslim army from Spain pushed into France and was stopped by the mayor of Paris at the time, a man named Charles, who met them at Tours, near the city of Tours, and defeated them at the Battle of Tours, sent them back, and ended the Western expansion of the Muslims, widely believed to have saved Europe, because that particular general was bragging about how by that winter he was going to stable his horses in St. Peter's Cathedral in Rome. But he was stopped by Charles, a man that became known as Charles Martel, Charles the Hammer, in a fascinating battle. He was outnumbered. He met them on a hillside. They had all their horses they were fierce mounted warriors. He had his heavy infantry, but the heavy infantry always had a hard time fighting the mobility of Muslim cavalry. So what Charles did was he kept all his forces in the trees on this hill, knowing that trees would eliminate the Muslim advantage. Well, the Muslims were no fools, and they didn't go charging into the trees, so they just waited there. They waited outside the trees and waited for the Christians to get impatient or whatever and come out and charge them. But the Christians didn't. They just waited in the trees, which disguised their true numbers and neutralized the advantage of cavalry. In the meantime, another Frankish force went around and attacked the rear of the Muslim force and destroyed their baggage, destroyed their supplies, was able to slip in while the Muslim army was kind of, so now the Muslims were stuck. It's like if they go back, they can't just sit there anymore because they're out of supplies. If they go back, then they know they're going to get harassed all the way out of France, and it would be a catastrophe, much like Napoleon's army being harassed all the way out of Russia after the burning of Moscow. But on the other hand, if they charged, so they were kind of stuck between bad. So they eventually decided to charge, and they charged into the forest. It was after a week, 7 days of waiting. Martel had to be a very patient man. 7 days of waiting, the Muslims finally charged into the trees and were slaughtered. They didn't realize how many Franks and how heavy the Franks were armed, and they just destroyed them in the forest. And that was the end of Western Muslim expansion, basically forever. The Muslims were gradually pushed out of Western Europe over the next, until 1492, and Columbus sailed the ocean blue. And that cemented Charles Martel as the hero of Europe and led to the overthrow of the Merovingian dynasty and the establishment of the Carolingian dynasty. Now, so that was Charles. Charles' son was Pepin the Short. How would you like that to be your name for all of history? Great man, though. And the son of Pepin was also Charles, Pepin's son Charles. And Pepin's son Charles was known as Charles the Great or Charlemagne, which is a name perhaps that you've heard. Charlemagne was one of the most famous kings in this whole period, and for good reason. Charlemagne was a brilliant leader, brilliant administrator, led to a huge expansion of the Frankish Empire, was a strong promoter of Christianity, literacy, lots of things. You know, the reason why we have paragraphs and spaces between words and punctuation, periods and exclamation points, is all because of Charlemagne. They didn't have any of those before. If you see the really ancient writing, and it's just letters like this, right? And it all just runs together. And you have to know, like, where the one word ends and the next one starts, and paragraph divisions and punctuation. There was none of that in the original. Scholars under Charles's direction invented those things to promote literacy, to make it easier to read and write. And it was successful. There's a massive advancement of scholarship and literacy in the time of Charles. Charles also expanded the Frankish Empire. The Frankish Empire at that time was like the northern and central part of France. He expanded it south down into northern Italy and west out into much of Germany. So by the end of his reign, Germany, France, northern Italy, everything all in between was all part of the Frankish Empire. And he funded missionaries to go into all of those areas, especially into Germany, which was not Christian. It had never been Roman before. He funded missionaries to expand Christianity. Now, it was under, sometimes people talk a lot about people being converted at the point of the sword. That did actually happen under Charlemagne. Charlemagne didn't do that as a general rule. But in the case of the Saxons in particular, the Saxons were just really, they lived along the northern coast of France, the area, or Germany, what's even now known as Saxony. And, they were really, really resistant to Christianity. Which they saw as de facto being forced to submit to the Frankish Empire. And so Charlemagne, after trying, sending missionaries, having the missionaries get killed, finally he just conquered Saxony and told them all that they were going to be baptized, all of them at the point of the sword, and that then they would permit the missionaries to come in and actually try and convert them for real. And before we judge Charlemagne too seriously for doing that, recognize that the Saxons were cannibals. They were raiders. They were vicious. You know, every kind of stereotype you hear about horrible barbarian raiders, that's who they were. And ate their enemies. And sometimes didn't do their enemies the honor of killing them first. So yeah, they were tough customers. And so, it is interesting though that, Saxony always kind of sat uneasily under Christianity. And it is perhaps no accident that 700 years after Charlemagne did that, it was in fact a Saxon monk who sparked off the rebellion against the Roman Catholic Church. Martin Luther was from Saxony. So, France was never all that religious though, compared to a lot of places. They had their great share of Christian figures over the century, but they've always been much more interested in empire, much more interested in politics, military power, secular powers, and it's a long history of secular powers using Christianity as a tool to advance their political power. That's been pretty much, I mean, that's not hardly unique to France, but it has been a particular characteristic of France's religious experience throughout their time. Nonetheless, like I said, we all owe a great debt in a lot of ways to the work that Charlemagne the Great did. Charlemagne, one of the things he did was he promoted and funded the massive expansion of monasteries. Interestingly, at this time, after the fall of the Roman Empire, monks coming from monasteries in Ireland came down to visit France, the center of Christendom, and were extremely disturbed at the very low standards of Frankish monasteries, where nobody could speak Latin, for example. Nobody could read any of the old books. Their morals were, by that time, already pretty slid, where the Irish monasteries were much more diligent and learned in lots of ways. And under Charlemagne's encouragement, Irish monks engaged in a lot of reformation of Frankish monasteries, increasing the standards of behavior and scholarliness and so forth. And a lot of ancient literature ended up being preserved and copied due to that very initiative, due to the reformation of Frankish monasteries by Irish monks, interestingly. We just talked about Ireland. I've got Great Britain next on the list. But maybe since it was just St. Patrick's Day, maybe we should talk about Ireland a little first. If you look at your map, this was the state of, if you look at England there, you see there's a darker shade of pink and a lighter shade of pink, right? And then in the north there's the green, which is the blue, which is the Picts, and then there's the Ireland, which is the Scots. Now, when the Roman Empire collapsed, at that time, Britain was all Christian. And they were known as the Bretons, which were the Bretons were a mix of the local, the natives, the Celtic people that lived there before, and the Romans that occupied it. So it was a mixed Celtic and Roman people that lived in Britain. They were known as the Bretons. They were Christian, overwhelmingly. When the Roman Empire fell into that vacuum, started raids from the Angles and the Saxons and the Jutes. They come from over in Europe, what's now Denmark, you know, the peninsula that comes up from Europe, and then Saxony right there. Angles and Saxons started to come across and invade. At first they were just raids, and then they decided, hey, this land is kind of a lot of it's empty, so let's just live here. And they occupied that part of Britain down in the south and the east, and the native Bretons got pushed more to the west, what is now Wales. The Welsh people of today, of which Powell is a Welsh name, the Welsh people are mostly the descendants of the ancient Bretons, where the English people are mostly the descendants of the ancient Anglo-Saxons. Although there is a great deal of interbreeding, of course, and so those lines are not super distinct. Ireland, on the other hand, where the Scots were, the Scots and the Picts were never Christianized. They were pagans all the way up to this point. Well, there was a young boy named Patrick, a teenager, who was kidnapped in a slave raid by Irish pagan slave traders and taken to Ireland, where he was forced to tend sheep for his owners. And he was there for a number of years. When he found an opportunity, he escaped and went back to Britain. His father was a deacon in the church, and after a short while, Patrick had a vision. He said he had a vision from God instructing him to go back to Ireland and to evangelize his former captors. So he did that. As a young man, he went back over to Ireland all by himself. And it was unusual at the time because most missionaries back then usually operated under the protection of kings. He did not. He did not have any protection at all and was frequently in danger of his life. Traveled around England preaching the gospel. And as I said, was frequently in danger, had all kinds of adventures. And by the end of his life had succeeded in converting Ireland largely to Christianity as a part of the movement that he sparked. A really remarkable man in a lot of ways. And interestingly, he was not Roman Catholic and he was not Irish. And certainly would be appalled at the way that his day is normally celebrated today. A deeply godly and pious man. Sorry, what?
Plus they wear green.
Well, they wear green, yes.
Not the correct color.
Not the correct orange. Yeah. Well, probably Patrick probably didn't care about either one of those. But Roman Catholicism didn't come to Ireland until later. Roman Catholicism didn't really exist at this time. So as a result of now we sing the hymn "Be Thou My Vision" sometimes, right? That hymn is derived in part from a prayer which Patrick wrote, and so the lyrics are often referred to as Saint Patrick's breastplate. That's the name of the poem, which is the prayer, because his breastplate is the protection of God. His breastplate is prayer. His breastplate is and he was one that very much put that into play as one who traveled around and sparked a movement and converted England, Ireland, without ever having the protection of the civil government and often the hostility of the civil government. Like I said, a remarkable man. We've got time. Let's talk about England. So we already talked about how the Angles, the Saxons, the Jutes, came into the east coast of Britain. Now remember, the Bretons were already Christians. The Angles and Saxons, when they started coming in, and it was one of those tribes that ends up giving England their name. England comes from the Angles, Angleland, which was one of the Germanic tribes. And we speak of Anglo-Saxon people. That's where the Jutes just doesn't fit well into the name, I guess. But there weren't as many Jutes. But they set up a number of small kingdoms. Now, Pope Gregory the Great, this would have been in the 6th century or so, the story goes that he saw a young boy in a slave market in Rome, an Angle, and was taken by the boy's great beauty and the fairness of his skin, declared him an angel, and decided that he needed to evangelize the Anglo-Saxon people. The people of Rome, though, would not permit him to go. They wanted him to be, he wasn't the Pope at the time, but they wanted to make him the Pope instead, so they wouldn't let him go. And so he sent a Benedictine monk named Augustine. Augustine of Canterbury, he becomes known as, or sometimes Augustine the Lesser, in order to distinguish him from Augustine the Great. Again, what a honor to be known forever as Augustine the Lesser. But he went and found he brought a group of monks in England to England. He found a pagan king there who had married a Christian queen, and based on the inn that they had with the Christian, ended up getting the king to convert to paganism. That was very often the way it was done those days. Missionaries would first go to the king, the chieftain, and they would try and convert him. And if they did so, once they converted him, then the whole kingdom was de facto, he would just say, well, we're all Christians now because I'm a Christian. And he was the king, and the king decided the religion of the land. And after that, once the land was Christian as a whole, then the priests would go out and they would try and actually train people in Christianity, change the laws, change the practices, which was, you know, there was a recognition that just because the king had declared everyone a Christian, that of course didn't change people. You had to go and actually train and educate them. But that was the way it often went. And whatever we might think of such a practice, the fact is that that was what led to the spread. That was the means that was used to spread Christianity throughout Europe. Most of the places in Europe became Christian in just that way. Then he went out and began preaching and converting many thousands. Much of England became Christian because of Augustine's labors. Now you would kind of think that process would have helped the Anglo-Saxons and the Bretons to get along better, because the Anglo-Saxons were pagans and the Bretons were Christians, and now they were both Christians. Unfortunately, that was not the case. These things weren't always as idealistic as we would like them to be. When Augustine brought Christianity to Anglo-Saxon lands, he brought Roman Christianity, the Christianity of the Church of Rome, which taught things like a clerical celibacy, for example, that priests had to be unmarried. Even the way they wore their tonsure, the way they wore their hair, the date of Easter, all these sorts of things, which were all really proxies for the belief that Rome should call the shots, right? The Bretons had an older, what was called Celtic Rite Christianity, which was the older Christianity that had been there all the way back from the beginning. It was also the Christianity that Patrick practiced, that Ireland was converted to. But Augustine used the power of the Anglo-Saxon kings to enforce Roman Rite Christianity on all of England, even over the Bretons. And there were wars that were fought over it, which Augustine supported. So he was a creature of his time in a lot of ways. And so that was the Breton Christians. They resented Rome's attempts to take power over them, and the rift remained between the two for many centuries. But one of the results of all of this was that England, though, became an intensely religious country. England was far more religious and has always been more religious up until very recently, was always more religious than, say, France, for example, which was always more secular. And a lot of the credit for that does go to Augustine and his labors there. Any questions? We'll talk about Germany, and we'll draw some conclusions next time, talk about a couple more figures. As I said, even though it was spreading, we see the conversion of, this is how, you know, France was Christian already under, Germany becomes Christian, a lot of it under Charlemagne, England becomes first less Christian and then more, Ireland becomes Christian for the first time, later on that would spread north to what's now Scotland. The Romans had never conquered Scotland. They tried, but after they just said it's too hard, it's not worth it. There's not enough up there to make it worth dealing with these crazy Picts. And so they just built a wall across it and said, you just stay up there. And that's what's now Scotland. So this is how Christianity consolidated in a lot of Europe, even as it was being lost in a lot of other areas. Any questions or comments? That colored map on the back shows the state of the various barbarian empires. Like I said, some of which we haven't talked about a great deal, like we didn't talk about the Thuringians or the Alemanni or the kingdom of the Gepids or the Burgundians, various other. There were lots of tribes and kingdoms. They were mostly pretty temporary and got consolidated under these larger empires that developed. All right, well, let's go ahead and close in prayer. Heavenly Father, thank you so much for your blessing. Thank you again for preserving your church throughout these centuries, and some of these centuries that were exceedingly dark in lots of ways, where the candle of the gospel must have seemed to have almost gone out, Lord. But nonetheless, you had your plans and purposes, and we're preparing for the future. We thank you for that. We thank you for your perseverance and your wise and providential plans in advancing your kingdom throughout the centuries, Lord. We pray that you would grant us faith and trust in you, that we ourselves would engage in that work in whatever role that you've given each one of us to do in our families and our church and our communities, to your glory and to the glory of your Son, Jesus Christ. In his name we pray. Amen.